as always, we are so grateful to Bill and all the musicians for the wonderful music they produce Sunday after Sunday. And of course, that's a product not only of the music team here, but also of our sound people. And especially as we think ahead to the Christmas concerts this week, we can be very grateful for the wonderful people that the Lord has blessed us with here at Grace Community Church. And also at the same time, pray for them, particularly for their health, as they put in a lot of time and energy into the concerts that will be held Thursday through Sunday. Well, as Tom mentioned, we are continuing our study this morning of our series in Matthew's account of the Nativity, the birth of Jesus Christ. We've already looked at Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 to 17. Abner Chow explained that text and gave us the explanation of Matthew's purpose there in the lineage of Jesus. And then last Sunday, Phil Johnson walked us through Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 to 28, looking at the miraculous conception and the birth of Jesus Christ. We now come to the beginning of chapter 2 and to an exceptional event as well in the early life of Jesus Christ, the pilgrimage of the Magi. Part of me had hoped that in preparation for our study this morning that Bill would have led us in singing We Three Kings. It is in Hymns of Grace, it's number 228. I won't go through that, but we're familiar enough with the lyrics to know that there is some artistic creativity that is used in that carol to describe what we find in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. And whether it is the carol itself or the depictions of the Magi on Christmas cards or in nativity sets, there certainly is a lot of tradition that has developed that has accreted over time with respect to this most fascinating portion of Scripture. And of course, there's reasons for this. By all accounts, the visit of the Magi is highly unexpected in Matthew's narrative. It's, you could say, exceptional. And as such, it certainly attracts our curiosity. It is only recorded here in Matthew's Gospel, and no other references or allusions are made to it elsewhere in the New Testament. And in just a few sentences, Matthew introduces us to these obscure travelers. He links their movements to a revelatory light. He describes their extraordinary behavior and then tells how they silently escape back into obscurity, never to be mentioned again. Matthew simply abstains from feeding our curiosity, simply gives us few details, and it's these white spaces that tend to lead to speculation, even allegorism, leading then to the misconceptions that sometimes we entertain as it relates to these Magi. For example, that there were three of them is nowhere stated in the text. Perhaps the closest we get to that are in the three kinds of gifts that are given to the child Jesus. Or that they were kings is also not sustainable. In fact, there's nothing in the term, as we'll see, nothing in the term magi that would lead us to believe that these are potentates of foreign nations. If we would look at Roman Catholic tradition, their names were Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. And if you're ever in Germany, you can go to the Cologne Cathedral and pay a visit to their bones. Now, these kinds of details certainly try to satiate our obsession with what is not written there, with the white spaces, but that also sometimes can obscure from our vision that which is written. And in this text, there certainly is much profound theology. So turn in your Bibles, and we're going to look at this text this morning. It's Matthew chapter 2, and we'll look from verses 1 through 12. Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah. For out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. And when you have found him, report to me, so that I too may come and worship him." After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star, which they had seen in the east, went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. After coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. Now, before we get into this passage this morning, it's important quickly to consider Matthew's purpose in writing this gospel. As has been noted already, Matthew writes this gospel to prove that Jesus is the rightful heir to David's throne and to all that that entails. He is the one who will rule an everlasting kingdom and whose dominion will cover the entire earth. And when we specifically turn to Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, we see how Matthew contributes to this overall purpose by showing that Jesus was indeed born a king. He was recognized as such, and born as a king not only as it related to the people of Israel, but born as a king also over the Gentiles. Matthew achieves this purpose by telling the testimony of these Magi in their own words, telling how they recognized Jesus' unique status as king and describing their joyful adoration of him. The way we'll outline this text this morning is by recognizing three stages in the development of this narrative. We can discern three scenes, you could say, as any great narrative has, three scenes. The first scene is found in verses 1 and 2. It's the search of the Magi. Then in verses 3 through 8, we see scene 2, the rejection of the rulers. And then we come to the final scene, scene 3 in verses 9 through 12, and it is the worship of the king. In fact, this narrative has all the pieces of a great narrative that we would expect. Of course, not like the Christmas folklore that we are so accustomed to, but as true as real history. And so in scene 1, in verses 1 and 2, we'll see the narrative's introduction and the inciting incident that leads to this whole narrative. In scene 2, in verses 3 to 8, we'll see the narrative's conflict. We'll see the rising action that takes place. And then in scene 3, in verses 9 through 12, we'll see the narrative's climax and its final resolution. Let's look first at scene 1, verses 1 and 2. And as in any narrative, it must begin with historical setting, and that is exactly what Matthew does. He writes this, verses 1 and 2. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Now, the first historical detail that we find here that fits us for the historical setting is that some amount of time had passed after the birth of Jesus. We read of that in the end of chapter 1, verse 25. And then we have the visit of the Magi, and some amount of time had passed. We don't know how much. It's not stated in the text, but we can glean several details. And there's good reason to believe that a considerable amount of time had elapsed by the time the Magi arrive. First of all, most plainly, Jesus is no longer in a stable. As Matthew 2, verse 11 states, the family was now residing in Bethlehem in a house. But even more importantly, Matthew states in 2, verse 16 that later on, when Herod orders the slaughter of all the male children in Bethlehem and its vicinity, Herod applies this order to all male children 2 years and younger. And therefore, it's reasonable to believe that Jesus was somewhere in between several months old and 2 years old. Probably, we could say, somewhere between 6 months and 18 months. Matthew also mentions here, as part of this historical setting, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. Now, notice Matthew's historical accuracy. There was another Bethlehem, a Bethlehem in Zebulun to the north. But Matthew is showing us Jesus' connection to the tribe of Judah, and specifically to David. Bethlehem of Judea was David's town. This is the Bethlehem of David, the great king. And in Jesus' day, the city probably had around 1,000 residents. It was not a fancy place. In fact, it's called the House of Bread because it was in an agricultural area, and in Jesus' day, it was mainly inhabited by shepherds, those of the lower class of society. So we can expect, we can surmise that Joseph, Mary's husband, the legal father of Jesus, recognized, especially because of the announcement of Gabriel, recognized that this baby was the king, was David's son, and there was no better place for him to grow up than in Bethlehem. And so Joseph procures a place there in Bethlehem to raise Jesus. There's another detail here of the historical setting. It's in verse 1, and it's where Matthew says that the visit of the Magi corresponded to the days of Herod the king. This Herod, also known as Herod the Great, is not the same Herod that we meet later on in the New Testament. There were several Herods. This one is the head. He was voted in as king of Israel in 40 BC by the Roman Senate, and it took Herod several years to secure his grip on power. And he ruled then from 37 BC to 4 BC over this part of the world. His rule encompassed Judea, Samaria, Galilee, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. And this Herod was not a true Jew. He was an Idumean. He was an Edomite. He was one of the descendants of Esau. And the people, the Jewish people, hated him. But he enjoyed the support of Rome, and that for him was all that really mattered. Now, for some, Herod was an exceptionally gifted leader. He instituted ambitious public works and building projects. Some of them we even are familiar with today. He reconstituted the temple and its foundation. If you go to Jerusalem and see the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, that's a result of Herod's building projects. He also established fortresses in Jerusalem and on Masada. And he also built the great port that is there on the Mediterranean known as Caesarea Maritima. But he was paranoid. He was jealous. He was shrewd. And he was cruel. He killed one of his wives, three of his sons, and even his mother-in-law. Because of his suspicion over his family, Caesar Augustus supposedly said this of Herod the Great: "It is better to be a pig in Herod's court than a son." It is well attested that eventually, in 4 BC, Herod the Great dies a very painful death. He suffered from kidney disease, severe infection, and gangrene. And so because he dies in 4 BC, we generally place the birth of Jesus sometime prior to that, somewhere between 6 BC and 4 BC. Now that's the historical setting given to us in this first scene. There are also some other details that Matthew gives us in this first scene in verses 1 and 2. And he introduces for us, for example, in the second part of verse 1, the main characters. Herod is actually not the main character. The main characters are magi from the east. And it doesn't come through in our translation, but Matthew includes a note of exclamation when he introduces these travelers. He says, "Behold, magi from the east." He wants us to know that these men are extraordinary. Now, who were the magi? As we already noted, there's a lot of speculation about who they were, and we really don't know specifically the identity of these magi, and that's okay. It's not really the point. But from what we can tell from this word magi is that they were not kings. Rather, they were from a very esteemed priestly caste who focused their attention on philosophy, on the study of natural sciences, observing stars and planetary movements, and on the interpretation of phenomena like dreams. In fact, a possible reference to this caste of Oriental wise men is found in the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 1 and in chapter 2 and in chapter 5, we meet in that book these Babylonian magicians. It's from the same word, magi, magician. And they are those who were called upon specifically to interpret dreams. Matthew adds that they were indeed from the east, and that would mean that they were from these oriental regions of Babylon, Persia, Arabia. And we know from those cultures in antiquity that they revered these wise men. But what is most important to note about these main characters is that they were Gentiles. This is Matthew's point. And it leads us then in this first scene to the inciting incident. In verse 2, the inciting incident of this first scene is found in verse 2 when these Gentile wise men arrive on the scene and they ask, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews?" Now, the importance of such a question cannot be overstated. Where is the King of the Jews? in terms of God's redemptive plan worked out in history. There cannot be a more important question with more global implications than this one. Of course, their question automatically ruled out Herod. He, first of all, was no Jew. He was a half-Jew at best, and he wasn't born a king. Herod was installed as a king by the Romans. Moreover, what is important to note with this question is to ask another one, and that is, how would these wise men even know about the importance of the King of the Jews? And Matthew provides a little bit of an answer when he says this in verse 2. The wise men say, "For we saw his star rising in the east." And that raises another question. What is the star? And what it is even more difficult to determine than the precise identity of the Magi themselves. There have been several attempts to explain it by natural phenomenon, like a supernova, as some have suggested, or a comet. Halley's Comet, for example, was known to have made an appearance in 12 BC. The 17th century astronomer Johannes Kepler advanced the theory that the star represented the planetary alignment of Jupiter and Saturn, which is known to have taken place in 6 BC. But the problem with these natural phenomena is that they occur high in the heavens, and that doesn't fit well with the language of Matthew's text. For example, in verse 9, Matthew records that this star went on before them, before the Magi, to Bethlehem. And it came and stood over the place where the child was. This is exceptional. And it's best to see this as a unique, miraculous, supernatural phenomenon. It does not appear that it was visible to everyone. And it specifically guided the Magi from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, a distance of only 6 miles. And the light that it cast was so precise that it shone on the specific dwelling of the child. But beyond that, notice how this star captured the undivided attention of the Magi. Verse 2 says, "For we saw his star in the east, rising in the east, and have come to worship him." The star was seen, but it was recognized as pointing to something transcendent. The arrival of the King of the Jews, who was worthy of all worship. And this, not the star itself, this is Matthew's focus. It is the inciting incident. But it does cause us to ask as well, in the meantime, how would these Magi, seeing this star, make the association to the Messiah, to the King of Israel? Most likely, this information had come from the Jews themselves. Centuries earlier, thousands upon thousands of Jews had been exiled. Men like Daniel, to the oriental regions, to Assyria and to Babylon and to Persia. And as these exiles were sent to the east, the faithful remnant among them not only shared the truth about the one true God, Yahweh, and his plan of salvation through the Jewish Messiah, but they also brought with them portions of the Old Testament. They had written messianic prophecies like Genesis 49:10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Or Numbers 24:17, part of the oracles of Balaam, "A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down all the sons of Sheth. Or perhaps it was the announcement that Daniel recorded in Daniel chapter 9 of the 70 weeks. Whatever they had of the Old Testament, whatever familiarity they had, it was enough for them to identify this Jewish child as the one who was worthy of their own worship. They just didn't have all of the information, which is why they asked the question, where is he to be born? But they had enough to know that he was to be worshipped. And this is shocking. In Matthew's Jewish gospel, it is important to note that the first people who come specifically with the singular intent to worship, the first people to respond were the Gentiles. In a way, the arrival of these Gentiles reflected the way it was supposed to work in Old Testament times. Israel had a great commission. Israel was to be holy to Yahweh. Israel was his own possession. And Israel was to worship him in spirit and in truth, and then to be a kingdom of priests, all with the view of attracting the Gentiles from the farthest reaches to Jerusalem so that those Gentiles would come and worship Yahweh as well. It was the Old Testament Great Commission, but Israel had largely failed in this commission, and it took a star for these Gentiles to arrive on the scene, but they did. And they arrive on the scene as Old Testament era, God-fearing, Christ-anticipating Gentile saints. They came to the city of God, and they knew what their duty was, to worship and rejoice. And that leads to scene two. And we see scene two in verses 3-8, and scene two of this narrative is the rejection of the rulers. Scene two constitutes the rising action and the conflict in this story. And for the first time in Matthew's gospel, we have the themes of resistance, rejection, and persecution. Let's note first the rising tension. Verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, if you haven't already noticed, there is a play on the word king. It's found numerous times in this text. In verse 1, it's Herod the king. Verse 2, it's King of the Jews, which is a reference to Jesus. Then again in verse 3, it's Herod the king, and we'll see it once more in verse 9, the king referring to Herod. So what we see here is a clash of the kings, and it's the inquiry of the Magi that sets Herod off. What? Another king? It cannot be. Perhaps Herod was familiar with these Old Testament prophecies too. But whatever it was, the announcement of the king of the Jews being born set him off. He could not find rest. Verse 3 says he was troubled. The meaning of that verb means to have inward turmoil, to be thrown into confusion, to be mentally troubled, to be greatly disturbed. In fact, he became so deranged at this point that Matthew records that not only he was troubled, but all Jerusalem with him, which indicates that Jerusalem wasn't so much concerned about what the Magi were seeking. They were more concerned about assuaging Herod's insanity. They didn't want to see his cruelty. That was what they were interested in. And that leads then to a perplexed inquiry in the second scene. We see it in verses 4-6. Gathering together all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, Herod inquired of them, where the Messiah was to be born, and they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet." "Out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Herod gathers the chief priests. This, of course, would be the chief priest himself, previous chief priests who had served in that office, their administrative members, and the entire Sanhedrin. He also gathers together the scribes, the biblical scholars, the lawyers, the teachers of the people. These would be the Sadducees and Pharisees all together. And so in response to the question of the Magi, these Oriental travelers, Herod convenes a massive conference, all in order to find the answer to this question: where is the Messiah to be born? And the religious rulers give their answer: in Bethlehem of Judea. And how did they know? This is a pretty specific answer to a question. Not just somewhere, approximately, but in a specific village. How did they know? Well, the text tells us they found it in the scriptures. Notice their confidence. Verse 5, "For this is what has been written by the prophet." They acknowledge the authority of the Jewish Old Testament. They recognize the authority of the scriptures. And they say it stands as having been written. They acknowledge the inspiration of the text when they say it was given through the prophet. And they acknowledge the right hermeneutic to apply when reading that Old Testament, when they proceed to read the prophecy literally. And what they provide here is actually, it seems like a little bit of a conflation, actually, of several texts. Obviously, it is a citation from Micah 5, verse 2. Micah prophesied some 700 years before the coming of Jesus Christ. And in Micah 5, verse 2, we read this: "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel." His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. A few verses later, Micah goes on to say, "He will arise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will remain, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. This one will be our peace." Now, if you look back at what Matthew records as to the answer of the religious leaders, there is a little bit of paraphrasing that they introduce here in the text, but it is all consistent with a literal interpretation of that Old Testament promise. 700 years prior to his appearance, the appearance of this king. And that then leads to the sinister plot that we find at the end of this second scene. We find it in verses 7 and 8. "Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and search carefully for the child. And when you have found him, report to me so that I too may come and worship him.'" Of course, he said this with his fingers crossed. He had no intention of worship. And he enlists the Magi as unwitting informants. And in his paranoia, he hatches this plan to secretly murder the Messiah of Israel. And right here, at the end of the second scene, verses 7 and 8, Matthew introduces to us one of the primary themes of the entire Gospel of Matthew, and that is the rejection of the king by his people. And you might say, well, wait a minute, this is just Herod. But actually, it's more. Yes, Herod's reaction is extreme, but don't miss what's missing. Having been informed of the circumstances and of the question of the Magi, notice the religious establishment of Israel does nothing. One commentator put it this way: it is strange how much the scribes knew and what little use they made of it. Or in the words of Augustine, these religious leaders were like milestones. They pointed out something to travelers, but themselves remained stolid and motionless. The irony here is great. They knew all the right answers, but they didn't care. They were more concerned with Herod's insanity. And that position of Herod, the position that he represents, that position of animosity and antipathy, the religious leaders will eventually get there by the end of Matthew's gospel. For example, you fast forward to Matthew chapter 26 and you read these words in verses 3 and 4, and it has an uncanny parallel with Herod's plot. Matthew records this: "Then the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him." The religious leaders eventually would become Herod the Great 2.0. That then leads to the third scene, the worship of the king in verses 9 and 12. Now we see the climax and the resolution. And the climax and the resolution are found in these verses. Notice, first of all, the joyful arrival in verses 9 and 10. "After hearing the king," that is Herod, "they went their way. The Magi went their way, and the star, which they had seen rising in the east, went on before them until it came and stood." It stood over the place where the child was. Now, as I said, it's only 6 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. It's a half day's journey, but the problem with Bethlehem, even as a small village, is that it still contained around 1,000 residents. That's a lot of different homes, but this star guided them. In fact, the way Matthew says it is again to draw our attention to the amazing supernatural phenomena. "And behold the star." The light source showed them the way to the precise dwelling where the child was. It fulfilled its purpose. It pointed the way to Christ. And we'll never hear of that star in Scripture again. Now notice verse 10. Verse 10 is so critical here as we see this building climax. Verse 10, "When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy." What Matthew's pointing to there is the fact that the star came and it rested over this dwelling, and they knew what that meant. And the language here is highly emphatic. The root word joy is mentioned twice along with the words great and exceedingly. It's not just that they rejoiced. It's not just that they rejoiced with joy. It's not even that they rejoiced with great joy. But Matthew says they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. You can imagine the anticipation and even the trepidation as they walked up to the door and they got ready to knock. "Balthazar, you knock." "No, Melchior, you knock." And then Caspar chimes in, "Men, we have come this far. This is it. On the other side of the door is the righteous king, whose goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. On the other side of this door is the great shepherd who will lead his people in the majesty of Yahweh. On the other side of this door is the one upon whose shoulders will rest the government of all the earth. On the other side of this door is the wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. On the other side of this door is Emmanuel, God with us. On the other side of this door is the hope of all the nations. And without even seeing him, they rejoiced. I think the wording of the first stanza of O Holy Night could have been written even by these magi. Notice the words. I think it captures well the scene there on that other side of the door. Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope. The weary world rejoices. But it doesn't end there. The climax is actually in verse 11, the humble adoration. This narrative leads to this moment. As part of this third scene, we see the climax. Verse 11, after coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshiped him. Matthew's very intentional here. He wants to show an immediate response. They knock at the door, and you can imagine this. Think of this. They knock at the door. The door opens, and they see this baby perhaps crawling in one of the rooms. And immediately, they see, and they fall, and they worship. No chit-chat. No small talk. Instant worship. Now, Joseph isn't mentioned, and that's because Joseph doesn't play a part in this. Mary is, of course, mentioned because she's the mother, she's with the child. But notice how Matthew describes the order of these names. It's the child that is the focus. It is the child with Mary and his mother. Notice it does not say the Blessed Virgin with her child. The young child, Jesus, is mentioned first. He is the focus, and Mary is now in the background. And this will be the case in verse 13, verse 14, verse 20, 21, always the child and Mary's mother. Befitting of the conduct of anyone who recognizes deity, Matthew says the magi fell to the ground and worshiped him, this little baby. These influential philosophers, stargazers, dream interpreters who had come to believe in the coming Jewish Messiah, they prostrate themselves, face to the ground, mouth in the dust, and they worship. The child was not only the king of Israel, the child was their king. And to show that, Matthew says, they opened their treasure chests and presented to them their wealth. What was it? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And notice that Mary does not receive these gifts. The gifts, verse 11 says, are presented to him. Mary has no intercessor status. They are focused on the child. Now we could try to surmise what these gifts stood for. The best thing is to realize these are gifts that are given to royalty. Gold is the currency of kings. Frankincense and myrrh, the aroma of royalty. They give the very best to the one they adore. And then to close out this scene, verse 12, we see the silent escape. The resolution to this narrative, having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. God is sovereign. Herod's plot is foiled, and the Magi silently steal away back home in a different way. It was not the Messiah's time to die. With respect to this foiled scheme, it reminds us of Psalm 2, verse 4, "He who sits in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them like Herod." But you know, the time will come for this Messiah to be pierced. It was necessary for this child to grow, to submit himself in obedience to his father, to fulfill all righteousness. And this king will eventually be formally rejected by all of the nation of Israel, at least for a time. And according to the predetermined plan of God, when the timing was right, he would be delivered to the Romans to be crucified on a cross. All to make propitiation for the sins of many, including those magi. And as we prepare this morning then for the celebration of the table that is before us, as we ponder this narrative and take it into our souls, it is more than appropriate for us to ask, what is my response? There is, of course, the response of Herod. He is the God-hater. He represents antipathy. He flatly rejects Jesus Christ, and if he could, he would drive the sword into this Messiah with his own hands. He represents those today who deep down inside seethe the idea of Christmas. And then there is the response of these religious rulers. They are the agnostics. They represent apathy. They know the right answers. They can pinpoint the specifics. They are the specialists. But they don't know Christ. They represent the scholars and theologians, the teachers and the influencers who know their Bibles so well, yet they do not adore Christ. And then there is the response of the Magi. They are the true worshipers, and they represent adoration. They will stop at nothing to declare their submission and loyalty and joy in the child that was born in Bethlehem. And they represent today those who are ready to come to this table to partake of it in remembrance of him, because this one who eventually was pierced for our transgressions is the joy of their souls. Where are you in your response? There is a prayer room to my right underneath those exit signs over there. And if this text strikes at your heart and you have a need for prayer or want to know this King, then after the service this morning, we beckon you to come, talk with the men and women who will be there who will explain this gospel to you. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this marvelous and unexpected account in the life of the young Messiah. We thank you for the grace that you would extend even to these distant Gentiles, that you would work in their hearts and give them the revelation they needed to recognize the identity of your Son, Jesus Christ, and how you drew them. We thank you for how you've drawn us and how to a weary world you have given this message of the Christ, a message that brings us joy. We thank you for all of this in his name. Amen.